For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So, welcome everyone. For those new to Ancient Dragon Zengate, I'm Taigen Layton, the teacher here, and I'm extremely happy to have with us this evening Dale Wright, who's longtime professor at Occidental College in Southern California, and a scholar of philosophy and Buddhism, and author of The Six Perfections, Cultivating Character.
Buddhism and the Cultivation of Character.
Excellent. And Dale also has co-edited with Stephen Hine, who's been here, numbers of books about koans and Zen history, and has been a practitioner, studied with Maizumi Roshi at CCLA and also in Asia. So I'm very happy to have Dale here to speak this evening. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm sorry to be towering up over so many of you. But years ago, my capacity to sit in a Buddhist meditation posture was deleted in a toboggan accident that took out my knee. So here I am, up high. So it's a pleasure to be here. I've known Taigen, your teacher, for many years, and you might not know this, but I'm a particular admirer of his. Some of you will know that in early Buddhism, they thought there are three fundamental components to practice. To be a serious Buddhist, you had to be cultivating morality and cultivating the Dharma or the teachings or developing a philosophy of life, and third, meditation. And Buddhist teachers through the years in various kinds have leaned one way or the other, stressing one of those or maybe two of them, but very few really go after all three with the ferocity that Taigen does. So that he's a scholar who is a Dogen scholar, and he's been practicing meditation, teaching meditation for decades. And for him, the practice of morality is much more than it was in early Buddhism. In early Buddhism, the first part was a prerequisite for the others, and that's that you had to follow the Buddhist rules, right? Basically, do no harm, and which is an important teaching. But now, for many of us, Buddhism demands more than doing no harm and following the rules. It requires of us participation in activities that seek justice, equality for everyone. And Taigen's been exemplary among Buddhists and globally in that respect. So it's a particular honor to be here to give this talk. So I'm going to talk about karma, and I need somebody to keep track of timing for me. So I understand we have an hour, and I want to talk for no more than 40 minutes. So when I talk for 40 minutes, is somebody with a watch?
I'll do it.
Okay, you just tell me. Okay, and then we're going to talk. So your job is to think and have questions and be ready to engage. Okay. So the initial topic is karma, and it's something I've thought a lot about it, but I've been studying Buddhism and developing a Buddhist philosophy, practice, and meditation for a long time before karma struck me as anything important. I didn't think it was so important. But so I need to tell you a little story of how it dawned on me that actually it's world, earth-shaking important. And here's how it happened. So I'm in Montana with a friend. We've been given a cabin way off in the mountains to go be for a week in a Jeep. And we're driving up into the Smack Cabin, way off dirt roads into the faraway mountains. And we finally get there and we get out. Oh, the fresh air. It's so great. Breathing deeply. And then we hear psss in the background. We look. Leaking air in the tire, And then we said, spare tire. We looked, no spare tire. There we are, dozens of miles beyond where a tow truck could ever get. So we leap into the Jeep. We race down the mountain again. And finally, we're going along, boom, boom, boom. We know we're in serious trouble. And so we stop. And now we're down low enough where maybe a tow truck could get to us or something. And we get out and we look, and now all four tires are slashed. And city slickers that we are, we didn't realize that Montana slate roads are to be driven very slowly. So when I raced down this mountain to get down, basically I slashed the tires. So finally, tow truck comes, long story, try to make it short. But the burly Montana driver, he's got grease all over him. Great guy, though. He loads us up, and we're sitting there in the cab with him, you know, driver, me, my friend, crunched together. And he's about late 30s, and we're talking, and I'm asking questions. And he says, well, I wasn't always a tow truck driver. I had a lucrative business here some time ago, and I raised hunting dogs. And he said he was raising about 20 dogs at a time, and they were highly prized. He was selling them for $6,000-$7,000 each and doing very well, living out in the wilderness, raising these dogs. He had a neighbor about a half mile away near his cabin, an old gruff guy living alone in his cabin who complained about the dogs barking occasionally. But one time the driver said to us, the old neighbor said, better shut them dogs up or I'm going to take care of it myself. And so, like Montanans, they traded threats back and forth a couple times and then, you know, just forget about it. But a week later, he comes back from being in town and all of his dogs have been poisoned and they're all dead or dying. And they all did die. And so the driver explains to us, he's absolutely in tears. It's just bawling and emotional distress, and he comes to the realization that he will need to get retaliation and do justice in this case. And so he explains, well, he got his shotgun and he got his pickup and he was going to drive his pickup right into the living room of the other guy's cabin and come out blazing with his gun. In other words, we said, you mean kill him? He said, yeah, kill him. And so we're getting a little tense in the car. He says, well, then, so he got in his car and he drove to this guy's cabin. When he got there, he noticed his truck is missing, so obviously he's not there. So he needs gas. He goes into town to fill up his gas tank before he goes and does his retaliation. But while pumping gas, the Baptist preacher, the one church in town, preacher comes and he's pumping his gas. He says, hey, John, how you doing? And John, tow truck driver, says, murmurs, you know. And then the preacher says, John, you okay? And he breaks down in tears. And he's just crying about his dogs. And so finally the preacher says, well, what are you going to do about this? And he says, well, I'm going to take care of it. And the preacher says, well, what do you mean, take care of it? And eventually the preacher draws it out of him. And he says, what is he going to do? And the preacher says, you can't do that. You just absolutely cannot do that. And John says, why? Why couldn't I get justice? And the preacher says, here's the point of the story, karma. That's the reason you can't do it. So when I hear this story, and John explains, the preacher then taught him what karma was. He said, all of your actions are forming your character. You are at all times, in everything you do, all your habits, your smallest movements, you are shaping yourself in some way. The fact that this old Montanan murdered your dogs, why would you then become a murderer like him? Why would you do that? And so, you know, this great story, unbelievable. So he didn't do it. And they agreed he'd go to the county sheriff 10 miles away. So my realization was this. Okay, here is a Baptist preacher in rural Montana, and the only resource he can come up with to convince this guy not to get revenge by killing his neighbor is the Buddhist concept of karma. And it works brilliantly, and it somehow pulls it off. And so I began to think, okay, well, what are the resources in other traditions? Right? What do you turn to if you're a Jewish or Christian or Muslim or whatever? And they all have them, but there's something about the idea of karma that's extraordinary. It doesn't carry with it necessarily all of the religious scaffolding that the other teachings require. So the preacher, she could have said, well, you'll go to hell. You know, God will make you go to hell if you do this. But he didn't do that because he knew that wouldn't be effective. He didn't believe in that. But karma, it can, is a principle, it can work on its own. Right? Your actions will shape your character. Okay, so that was the realization to me. So I began to try to formulate more about karma, learn more about it, and began to try to hone it critically, because once I really got into it, I realized there are a number of parts to the idea of karma as it is typically thought of in Asia that are, in contemporary culture, just inadequate, that have to be purified, has to be cleaned up a little bit to work, but it's the only resource like that in world culture that is a basic principle for morality. It tells you why you ought to practice moral relation to others in society. Okay, so I'm going to just focus on one difficulty with the concept of karma. It's not innate to karma necessarily, but it's one thing that has to be adjusted to make karma really work for us. And that would be that typically in Asia and everywhere, karma is thought of as in a very individualized way. Right? It's your karma. Right? So, and that's what the preacher was teaching to John the tow truck driver, that it's you're doing something to yourself when you do this act. But in fact, had he murdered the old guy, his neighbor, he would have been doing something to the whole society, the whole community. So that there's the way karma is usually thought of in most societies is it's as though you're sliding down through a glass tube through your life, separated from others, and the actions you do are impacting you, but not others, right? Not your community. So you're sliding down in reincarnation, rebirth, you make a flip, you go down further. So it's like you're isolated from others. But really, if we think about the effects that our acts have, they shape us, to be sure, but they're also shaping the community or family, people around us. Everything we do has repercussions on everyone around us. I mean, even the most simple thing, the way you greet people, shapes the way they feel in that moment. And it might shape what they do in the next moment of their greeting somebody else. So the karma is very much a community principle as well as it is individual. And so my realization was that when Buddhism developed, at the time Buddhism was born, what was happening in world cultures, it's called the axial period when all the great religions and philosophies were emerging, it was a time of individualizing, a realization that the individual is important. And so Buddhism is the first place where this happens. And it happens later in Christianity, you know, 4 centuries later. Christianity is a very individualized spirituality, right? Much more than Judaism, where Judaism is the origins of Christianity. But in Christianity, it's you, your actions, your sins, and avoidance of sin will determine whether you're going to heaven or hell in an afterlife. And so again, it's a very individualized spirituality. But what's important to recognize is at that time in world culture, this was a breakthrough. You know, Buddhism started something, invented something that had huge and important and valuable repercussions. And our sense of individuality that we practice as Americans and as Westerners and as people in the modern world, and it owes so much to those beginnings of a strong sense of individual, self-reliance, and so on. Very important. Okay. Now, that develops that sense of the individual as being important and the community less important. Develops much more in the West than it does in Buddhist countries. Most Buddhist societies are much more collective and communal in sensibility than we are. But my realization now is that this is one contribution that Western Buddhists, or global Buddhists as we better call them, or contemporary Buddhists, one contribution that we will make to the history of Buddhism is to develop the communal character of it, develop the sense of karma and other parts of it that where there's a strong sense of being part of the community in very important ways. So there's some irony to that, that in the midst of the most capitalist, the most individualist, the most modern culture in the world, I think that a strong communal sensibility will develop in Buddhism. And I think it's already happening. It's happening in this group and elsewhere. A different awareness of community. But it's like a pendulum swing, that we have become as individualized and as lacking in communal sensibility as we can possibly be and survive. And we're headed back the other way. Whereas China, they dropped all their communal orientation, right? Communism, Maoism, and they're headed back towards, you know, laissez-faire capitalism. And so we're moving in a direction, I think, beginning to, that will open up new avenues. But it's also, we live in a moment of history when it's hard not to be aware of our interdependence with all other people in the world. So there's a global awareness that we have that we live in a world of economic interdependence, right? So that what happens in the Chinese economy, we now know, affects us and the Latin American economy, the European economy. Politics, what happens in our political world has a huge impact on what happens in Europe and Latin America. So the world is interconnected, and we understand that better than we did even 50 years ago, in my youth. And certainly in the height of modernity in the 19th century. That's one thing. So also the environmental and ecological disaster that we are about to face, or beginning to face, ties us together. Because we all now realize we share one planet. Now, I live on the west coast of the United States, where people that are measuring stuff in the atmosphere realize that air pollution from China doesn't sink into the Pacific Ocean. It floats right over onto the West Coast. And that's been true of us. We've been emitting it across the country for centuries now. There's one planet, and we share it, and there's one environment that we now need to come together in order to understand how to repair the problems we've created. I would mention other developments that have happened historically, the invention of socialism in Europe, or what's come out of socialism in European theory, Marxism, is the social democracies of Europe, where they realize that we have a better society in Germany and France and England. We have a better society if we supply health care to everyone, if everybody has that opportunity. If just basic needs are given to everyone equally, everyone then is a better citizen of the society, and so that invention is a breakthrough. Also, we have recognized to a great extent now that the kind of exclusivity or otherness that we practiced for so long, that discrimination based on gender and sexual orientation and race, religion, those kinds of discriminations, it's now widely part of our moral sense that that's wrong. And that wasn't true in the past, right? So that's a new sense of our belonging together, so that everyone participates with us, right? Everyone's part of an us in a large sense. No exclusivity. Also now we recognize intellectually that we all have the same evolutionary origins, right? We all come from the same stock of human beings that emerged in Africa long, long ago. And so all of that sense, to the extent that we realize it, we realize we're one people on one planet, and we have to get together to practice that and to realize it in a much deeper way. And so our various little devices that we all have, that's just the tip of the iceberg, the fact that we can communicate. There's all these larger realizations that all of us have to some extent now, and everybody in the world is getting this, that we're there's one planet and we're connected. All of those realizations are going to draw us into the development of a global community. We have no choice but to do that. We have to live in the world together. And I think because in Buddhism there is this brilliant principle of interdependence, that all things are linked together, Western Buddhists or global Buddhists, contemporary Buddhists will be able to use that idea and to develop the principle of karma and other sides, other parts of community that will help to bring about change in the world. Okay, so there's something ironic about that, but nevertheless, that's my thought. One thing that we realize to a great extent is that when we think about what each of us has achieved in our lives, and the fact that we're even here and have the leisure and luxury to be here in this environment means we've succeeded in life, and we're fortunate to be Americans. But that if we really think about it, we realize that, or let me just put it on my side, I realize that my life has gone the way it's gone, and I'm able to be here, and I'm a teacher, and I'm mostly successful in life. Not just because I was so good, and I worked so hard, and I achieved so much, but because my parents did things for me, my teachers did things for me, my community, my society, all of those links enabled me to live a good life. You know, not a great life, but a good life. So when I pass a homeless person, you know, the difference between us is great. I mean, it just is by anybody's estimation. But if I realize, had this person, this homeless person's parents did for him what my parents had done for me, and had his teachers done for him what mine did for me, and his community, and on, he wouldn't be in this situation, right? And had my upbringing been more like his, I'd be more like him, right? So we now realize that that individual pride that we have, and rightly so in many cases, to be proud of what you've accomplished, is relative to all the things that we've been given, that have been given to us. And so now young professional athletes, you know, they're interviewed after their great victory. And Jordan Spieth just won the U.S. Open golf tournament, or basketball players, or hockey. What do they say when they're interviewed after their great victory? Or somebody gets the MVP, the most valuable player. They say, well, I worked so hard for this, and I'm so great. No, they always say, no, it's so much support. My teammates are so great. The coaching staff, you know, the trainers, all of, we're a team. We develop this together. Now, these guys, of course, are taught to say that, but that is just a growing realization that these athletes have. So when, if you follow golf at all, and Jordan Spieth says, really, it's not just me playing golf, it's this whole team. He's got a caddy who knows the golf course and other people who train him. It's a collective effort. Now, we realize that about everything. You know, the more we think about it, the more we realize that individual achievement is important to recognize, but it is also set in a larger context of community, making it possible. Right? So, those realizations are growing, right? We have a much deeper, richer sense of that than people in the past ever have. And it has made possible things like our getting a minimal healthcare program in the United States, so that people, more people can get access to healthcare they need in order to be able to achieve something and make it in their own life. So we also realize that the narrow focus, if I'm a Buddhist practitioner, the narrow focus on my enlightenment really will undermine my ever achieving any degree of enlightenment, right? If my self-centeredness is so great that I'm just focused on my being enlightened, and I might do moral and good things to you, but I only do it because I want to generate good karma, we realize how shallow that is, right? That that focus on my own achievement in spiritual matters robs me of the kind of selfless engagement with others that the true depth of Buddhist no-self really means. Right? That more and more we can recognize the truth of that, that the spiritual quest can't be narrowly focused on one's own achievement. Right? Now, it's okay, it's not a terrible thing if we engage in an individual spiritual quest for our own well-being, and it's not a terrible thing if you're kind to people just because you want to get good karma for yourself. It's better you do that than you do nothing, right? But everybody starts where they are. You start where you are. But once you begin to do things that are recognizing the necessity of generosity towards others, openness to others and community, then the sensibility grows. Incrementally, little bits and pieces, it grows and gets greater. It's interesting in this historical development. I said Buddhism was the first religion to really have an individualized spirituality. And it was highly individualized. So karma worked individually. Meditation is a very individual thing, even though you can do it here. Really, it's what you're doing inside of your mind, and either you do it or you sit there messing around or do whatever you do. It's up to you to do it. So there's a very individualized sense to it in the origins of Buddhism. But if you go back prior to Buddhism, to the oldest religions, both Hinduism or the Brahmanical early tradition, or before Islam and Christianity, to Judaism, there is this strong, archaic, communal sensibility. Right? People, it was the community that mattered, not the individual at all. So, but the limitations of those ancient sensibilities were that it's the strong sense of community, but then you draw lines in the community. It's our community as opposed to others, right? Or it's our ethnic group or our religion as opposed to other ones. So what we need to develop is a strong sense of what Buddhists call non-dualism, right? Non-dividing the world into parts of the us and them. Right? That overwhelming practice that we all do where we divide things up into good guys and bad guys, and every one of us does it, if we're at all honest with our internal selves. We all do that, right? There's the politically, the people you disagree with, it's hard not to be disdainful and think of them as not part of we, but they're the others. The people in the Pentagon and ISIS, they both think they're doing good. The Chinese and the Tibetans, they both think they're doing the right thing. The Israelis and the Palestinians, they both believe they're on the side of the good and the right. And everybody has that. To get skillful, an important idea and concept in Mahayana Buddhism, skillful means to get really skillful at bringing about the gathering of people into successful community work entails this developing the sense of non-dualism, where you get really good at communicating to other people that it's not me against you. I'm not trying to be right, and I'm not trying to just deny what any truth to your position, but to communicate a sense of acceptance and or having to work this out together. That skill, some people have it, and it's, when you see it in a large measure, it's so admirable. Right? So when you study Martin Luther King Jr., and if you ever get a chance to read his letter from Birmingham jail, and he's been totally unjustly thrown into jail, and he writes a letter basically, he didn't know it, but developing the Buddhist idea of interdependence. Right? He said, we're all in this together. So he practiced the Christian effort to love your enemies, right? And he's somebody who could actually pull that off. I don't claim to be even close to that, but the Dalai Lama's done that with some success. Thich Nhat Hanh, another great Buddhist, Mahatma Gandhi, study the life of Gandhi, you see a practitioner of non-dualism to extraordinary degrees. And there's an old movie just entitled Gandhi that's just brilliant in that regard, showing Gandhi's non-dualism. So non-dualism means developing a sense of non-antagonism towards others, to not demonize the other side, and to be able to impart a recognition that we were working together and not separately. Now, Buddhists are mostly good about this, but if you follow the news, you know that Buddhists in Sri Lanka are treating Hindus badly in some ways. And in Myanmar, what used to be called Burma, Buddhists have developed something of an anti-Muslim sentiment. Now, as I said to Taigen earlier, I mean, we can't underestimate the kinds of tension and the poverty and the difficulty in those situations. I mean, everybody in Myanmar is poor almost. I mean, it's a very poor country, scarce resources, and you have people whose practices are so different between the Muslims who are there and the Buddhists, practicing non-dualism and acceptance and tolerance and generosity towards the other, extraordinarily difficult. And as good as Europeans have been at that, better than Americans for the most part, not always, obviously, but recently, you know that the rise of the right side of the political spectrum in all European countries is growing because of the immigration. I mean, they feel their culture is under assault, and it's so difficult. And if you're French, for example, you can say, okay, we have socialized medicine, we have lots of aspects of socialism, and it's great, but as long as it's French people, but if there's these Africans and there's these Muslims, it becomes much more difficult. And we shouldn't downplay what those difficulties are, but nevertheless, those are the obstacles for us developing a global community. So the difference between the kind of communal sensibility that we need to develop and the ancient one is that in a traditional sense of collectivity or community, individualism and uniqueness of the individual had to be stomped out, right? No individual expression. And this happened in communist China, right? In Maoist China, that China was traditionally quite a communal society, but that had fallen away in modern society. And when the Maoist revolution took place in 1949, all individualism was out of the question, right? Everybody had to dress exactly the same, had to speak in the same ways, had to read the same literature. You weren't allowed to read anything else. Absolutely wiping out of individual uniqueness in order to bring back this deep communal sensibility that we have. But we can't do that, right? That's the pendulum just swinging like this, back and forth. Then after the communist era, as we know in China, now they're totally doing laissez-faire capitalism, everybody do whatever you want. And then, we'll swing back the other way. But instead of that happening, for us to develop a kind of deep and richer kind of collective sense where we can incorporate otherness and difference and tolerate that people have different ideas of what enlightenment or the good in life is. People have very different conceptions of those, and it's hard to live together when that is true, but that's our task. That is the assignment that we now recognize that we have in a global community. And so the kind of communal sensibility that I'm talking about really has to develop in a way that doesn't stamp out our sense of individual achievement and our sense of uniqueness. You want to be as unique as you want, as long as you're treating others within certain moral boundaries. And we have to be able to accept that, right? We need to develop that sense. And, you know, we're getting better at it. And that's my sense that our pendulum has swung, right? That we recognize that gender and sexual equality and tolerance across many different sorts of lines is essential for us to be a true democracy. Okay, so what has to happen, my claim is, what has to happen to the Buddhist concept of karma is something like what's happened to our concept of democracy. So democracy began in Greece, and some of you who know something about this know that democracy then meant that a tiny handful of men, landowning men, got to participate in decision-making, okay? When democracy was re-established in America and then in European countries and now in Asian countries, in America, we know that, well, only men could vote, and only men of a certain ethnic background, and only men of a certain sort. And then gradually those barriers began to seem unjust, right? One by one they crumbled. Well, the vote for women, women's suffrage, right? So the vote goes to women, goes to eventually African Americans. So basically the meaning of democracy has had to evolve. While we gradually, over time, realize of what would really be entailed in carrying through an adequate democracy, and this will continue to go on. We're not done. It's not like we've achieved it. People 100 years from now will look back at us and say, what were those people thinking? And look with some disdain at things that we're doing now that we're clueless about. Right? We should hope that happens, that they look down on us in the future, and that we do evolve in those ways. But that's happened in democracy. That needs to happen with the idea of karma, and it's already happening. We need to develop the concept so that it includes a deep communal sensibility, so that it's not just that my acts are shaping me, and therefore I will do my practice and go about my achievement without regard to you, but I recognize that everything I do has an impact not just on me, but on all of you and on larger communities and ultimately on everybody in the world. And early Zen Buddhists in China recognized that, and it's inscribed in a koan that I'm going to get wrong and I may need your help on. One koan says something like, when the cows in Hunan, can you finish it for me? Drink wine. The cows in another province in China get drunk. Okay, I don't know where it goes, but it's total nonsense. What do you mean? Those cows drink, those cows get drunk. But the idea is that everything that's done by these creatures here affects these and these and these and ultimately everything in the world. I mean, literally, every breath you draw has sucked a certain amount of oxygen out of the environment, right? We all living, and everything we do has a bearing on everyone. Now, 50 years, 100 years ago, it was inconceivable that what people did in Latin America or China or the Middle East had any bearing on us at all. Now we recognize it has an enormous bearing. And so that sensibility is what we have to cultivate and develop and really bring to the fore. Okay, I'm going to shut up right there and invite you to make comments or ask questions or say whatever is on your minds. Oh, please.
That was a great talk. Thank you very much. I was so glad when you brought up the cows, because the whole time you were talking, I kept wondering, why is he only talking about people? Everything we have, everything we do affects every living thing on the planet, not just people.
Absolutely.
And it's the one great awakening that needs to happen pretty fast.
Very fast. Now, you probably know statistics on the species, whole, not just individual, but whole species going extinct in a die-off that's just extraordinarily fast.
So there couldn't be a better time for this concept of community.
We need to get it, and we need to realize that Not only do we owe justice to all of the plants and animals on the planet, but that we're better off in their presence, right? That the world is a better place in every sense in their presence. So, we face huge issues of human population control, that the growth of humanity means that other things can't survive.
And we can't survive if they can't survive. There's no food on Earth without plants turning sunshine into food.
Absolutely right. Interdependence.
Ken?
Thank you for your talk. Yeah. So you brought up earlier dualism or non-dualism, and something that's kind of going through my head is that this concept of tribe or individuality or small group primate. So is it possible that both are true simultaneously, that we are all one and we are all very separate, right? And I think I heard you say some of that. And sometimes I struggle with how to hold that, I guess. So for example, with the shooting down south, you know, there were actually a couple days where I couldn't even understand what was happening, I guess. It just didn't touch me, and then it did. But then I think if someone were to come into Ancient Dragon and shoot Sangha here, that would have a different impact on me, right? It would feel different for me. I would know some of the people, and they'd be in my small group primate Sangha rather than my country group primate Sangha.
Right.
So I guess I'm thinking that both are true, right? That there's this, like I'm responsible, yet I'm also bound by my ancient twisted karma.
Yes.
Right, and so there's this like, just this like, I feel very out of control, and like there's not much that I can do. I feel very trapped in the ancient twisted karma, and then at the same time I feel very responsible.
Yeah, and that's very articulate and very true. In the Chinese and Japanese school of Buddhist philosophy known as Kagan or Huayan, where the idea of interdependence of all things is developed, there's this phrase, they have these meditations, philosophical meditations, and at the end it says, you were meditating on this is true, and this is true, and this is true, and they're simultaneously true. Simultaneously, at the same time, opposites that seem like they can't be true are true. Yeah. So just to take one, to go slightly different direction, there's never been a human being on the planet, nor will there ever be, this like you. You know, your uniqueness, all the factors that have made you be exactly who you are completely unique. That individuality is absolutely true. And well, at the same time, you're a member of a species, and you're a member of what Buddhists call sentient beings, that is, you know, conscious beings, and you're a member of living beings, and you're a member of beings, the broadest category in Western philosophy, just being itself. You know, so all of those are true simultaneously, and we have to recognize that and figure out how to think adequately with all those truths intersecting, where they seem to conflict. Right? So it seems to people that, well, if I'm really, you know, pro my little group or community, then I have to be against these other people. You know, but not true, can't be true. And if we continue to think that way, we will fail. Human race will fail. Thank you.
There was something. Your talk was very nice and very positive and seemed to sort of move in the general direction about how, you know, through, you know, sort of the task of contemporary Buddhism maybe is to sort of reconceptualize, rethink this whole idea of what this interconnection means and work together to sort of improve our karma or something. I mean, you know, move things in a positive direction. I'm wondering if you could kind of flip that around and look at it negatively for a moment and make suggestions about what we can do and what our responsibilities are and what tools we might have as Buddhists for bringing to awareness, coming to know the way in which we are constrained by the karma that we're participating in.
Do you know, is that, I think so, yeah. To take one side of that, the constraint is part of in Buddhism is dependent arising. Things arise and become what they are based on not just freedoms to unfold, but particular constraints, right? You probably didn't feel liberated by your parents at all. They're shaping you. I certainly didn't. But those constraints are at the same time, simultaneously, positive and negative. They shape you, whether they're good or bad. They form the particularity of things. So there's that sense that if there were no constraints, nothing would have any particular shape at all. Constraint is the shaping power in the world. So that that's basically to take a negative point and make it again a positive one. But it is, right? That is the individualizing power of reality, is to create things out of constraint, right? And limitation. The bigger challenge on the negative side is how to deal with constraint that is really of a negative sort. So, for example, to take one that just, you know, is heartbreaking to all of us in this room, right, that we all know that there are constraints on those of you who happen to be women, if you wander out into the city, that I don't necessarily feel, right? That I can walk down in the street any time of day, most neighborhoods, and I'm okay, right? But there's an artificial, unjust constraint on women's freedom. Right? That's just part of the world we live. And are working in all the ways we can to undermine that, to do away with that, to bring an end to that, in the same way that we're slowly and gradually begin to pick away at racism and gender inequality and so on. There will always, well, not necessarily always, but in our lifetime, there will always be constraints that we think of as truly negative and that shouldn't be there. I mean, I live in Los Angeles, like Chicago. There's a negative set of vibrations in the air. There was a brilliant little thing by Thich Nhat Hanh once published in the LA Times, just after Rodney King, the famous beating of somebody by the LA Police Department. And Thich Nhat Hanh basically says through this piece, you know, we're all in this together. It's not just bad cops, right? We have to go to the roots of the problem and begin to develop a sense that the violence is not just these bad guys' violence, it's our violence, right? We hold that in us, and we collectively and communally have that in our heads. Even if we're the most peaceful, loving Zen master, if we live in a violent society, we still have that in us, right? It's there. You have to have it. It's just there. So our working against those constraints is our assignment in life. I'm sure I got all of the dimensions of your question.
No, thank you.
No. Yes, college.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Did you go there?
I do go there, currently.
Interesting.
I'm curious if you could elaborate a little bit on what the implications of karma, the implications of the Buddhist reorientation of karma was and is, as opposed to like Jain or whatever, you know what I mean? I saw you gloss that, I think that's important.
Yeah, no, they're very different conceptions of karma. All of it's born in the Indian cultural world, right? That's where it comes from. And Buddhism simply inherits this. The ideas were invented, you know, gradually over centuries in India prior to Buddhism. And they were great ideas. So when the Buddha sat in meditation and he didn't think to say there wasn't a rebirth and karma. But because the Buddha also said there is no soul, There's no self, there's no part of you that's permanent. He couldn't very well say that your soul will be reincarnated after you die. So a very difficult reconception of karma and rebirth had to take place in Buddhism. And you may know the famous little parable that the Buddha says. He says it's like having two candles, this one's lit and this one's not, and you pass the flame from this candle to this one. And so is this flame the same as this one? Meaning, is this life, the next life, the same as this one? And the answer is, well, no, but yeah, kind of, but not quite, and sort of. And he says, well, just so. It is with from one life to another. It's not the same person. It's not your soul. You have no soul to be reborn, but there is a karmic lineage that has taken over another person. But part of what I'm saying is difficult with that is that that tends to think of it still individually, right? It's like, I'm living out the karmic repercussions of my individual past life over and over and over. But in truth, we know now, who I become is not just a result of the things I've done and achieved and, or not achieved. It's a result of all these things that have been done to me and for me and about me. And so the community's karma shift. So that's part of it. The ancient Jain conception, that's J-A-I-N, some of you have seen the word, and is in its initial form is this really, it sounds almost primitive, it was primitive, it's early, sense that karma is like a residue, a physical residue that attaches to your soul. And the more bad things you do, the more weight is on your soul, and your soul sinks in the universe. Whereas if you get rid of that karma, you stop doing bad stuff, your soul rises up into heavenly spheres. So there were different conceptions of it, and they all evolved over time. But it's unique to that Indian worldview. And, you know, it spread to went to East Asia, and other people picked up on the idea. But one difficulty with the idea of karma as it's conceived in Asia is that it's always attached to rebirth, right? And in a Western context, now probably some of you as Buddhists think of, think truly about rebirth, and others of you just shrug your shoulders and I don't know, and others you say no, there's no such thing as rebirth, you know, so a difference of opinion. But in a Western context where it's not part of our heritage at all, accepting the idea that after I die I'm going to be reborn, it's going to be me, particularly me, that idea, you know, I doesn't seem right to me. So it's not part of my Buddhism. There is that will be part of the evolution of the sense of karma. But in Asia, for the most part, karma and rebirth really go together. You know, and what I'm saying is that for us to really be able to develop the idea, we have to separate them out. That rebirth is an idea of sort of your afterlife destiny. What happens to you after you die? That's an important question. But karma is more just a natural principle that everything you do, what you're doing right now, what you're doing tomorrow, what you did yesterday, you're shaping yourself. You are forming yourself and you're forming your community, right? Everything you do has an impact on others and it shapes you. And that's just true, right? We all believe that. There's nothing magical about that. And so for me, separating those two ideas and saying for everybody, karma is true once you get the scaled down version of it. And we need to develop our understanding of it. Follow up question?
Yeah, I don't want to. Is that okay?
Go ahead.
I guess I was wondering about if you could speak to the importance of intention, like chetana, intention.
Intention.
Because that's what I think was interesting, because I don't really know what intentional society looks like on a global scale. Mm-hmm. And it seems like, because the Buddhist, you know, I mean, intention is like the Buddhist invention or like addition to.
That's right. So one of the sutras says, karma is intention, right? So what you intend is the primary repository of your karma. So you may intend to do good, but not do good. Accidentally, things go badly. But your intention is important. Right? But from my point of view, it's not the only thing that's important. That we hold everyone responsible to not just have good intentions, but to do reasonably good acts. So, you know, so there are degrees of killing, and it was what's called manslaughter, and I know what it's called now. But basically, you know, you're driving your car and you hit somebody you didn't mean to, you didn't intend to hit it, but you killed them. Okay? And so it matters whether you were being negligent in any way. So there, it's more than intention. Your act has a repercussion whether you intended it or not. But the difference between that and intentional killing, like tow truck driver, is huge, right? Enormous difference. So the Buddhists were right to develop the idea of intention. That's part of the development of individual consciousness that was so important in the evolution of human beings and human culture. So we shouldn't, when we're saying we need to develop communal sensibilities, we shouldn't underestimate how important it is that we develop this sense of uniqueness and individuality, that we have to hold them together.
So maybe one last question, David. A comment?
Yes. Two quick comments and lead segueing into a question. One is that interesting today that Governor Haley called for Confederate flags to be removed. So even though she said that you know, this horrible thing happened, which is, in a sense, bad karma for this individual. What's happened is that it's raised the consciousness of the legislature, and in fact, the governor herself, saying, we have to remove this, that it's time to take it down. And she will call the legislature in a session just for that, if they don't act themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, and the moral heaviness of that will be such that I can't see that they could say no. As much as they love that Confederate symbol. Okay, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, the other thing, the comment and segue into a question is, in the past, karma is used in a negative way by saying we're the elect. The Puritans had it. The monarchies in Europe had it. And even in Indian culture, the Brahmins had it. We're the elect because we've done all these good things. I see now the hardest thing, the question is, the hardest thing that I'm dealing right now with is ISIS.
Uh-huh.
There are people here who they are people who feel they're so right that everybody else has to submit to their way, and there's no arguing, there's no way to reason. They just, you're not Muslim, you're not the right Muslim, we kill you. And I'm having a hard time with accepting that within my own practice of being compassionate. And I'm asking you, show me a way.
I will show you a way, but I have the same problem. It's extremely difficult. But the formula I just gave from Thich Nhat Hanh is the one. Is that you can't just focus on the evildoers and even on the acts of evil entirely. You've got to seek the roots of evil, right? So why are these people like that, is the question. Well, they've been deprived of their lands. They have been the subject of imperialism. They've been subjugated under empires of other nations. They've been ridiculed. They have suffered kinds of suppression that we never had. And that they react in this way is not, it's not a good reaction. We can't applaud them for it, but we can begin to understand. So unless we're just going to say they're inherently evil, our only path is to find the roots. Where does that come from? So the Buddhist principle of dependent arising, which is really the same thing as karma, karma is just in the human sphere. Everything comes from someplace. Everything is caused by factors that precede it, and those factors are caused by factors that precede those. And if you trace it back, you can find where that level of hatred and anger comes from. and you know, and to really be able to sympathize, you have to go out of your way to put yourself in the shoes of people who live in under devastating cultural circumstances, and who just because of circumstances become completely warlike and so filled with hatred. What in Buddhism the three poisons are just pouring out of them. So now that's not that we need to be compassionate and let them do what they're doing, or that we can even be apologetic for it in any sense. But understanding where it comes from is the only way, ultimately, to do something about it. If you can deal with the circumstances that has given rise to that level of hatred, then you can deal with it. So in my city of Los Angeles, Thich Nhat Hanh says, yeah, you can fire the chief of police, you can reform the cops, and so on. But as long as you Angelinos, you people in Los Angeles, don't change your way of thinking, don't change what you're watching on TV and producing in Hollywood, violence, you are putting out violence. As long as you don't do that, you're just tinkering on the surface, right? There'll be more Rodney Kings, there'll be Rodney Kings forever. People getting beat up by the cops. The police are your hired gunslingers. You pay taxes to hire them. What kind of person is going to be a policeman in Los Angeles? Well, you're going to be tough as nails. You're going to have some anger in you. And so the whole society creates that situation. And Thich Nhat Hanh said, you want to deal with this? You really want to deal with this? Okay, don't just fire the chief of police. Get down into your own mind and do an inventory of the greed, hatred, and delusion that are in your own mind. Even you upper middle class, people who are fine and think you're very peaceful Buddhists living off in the suburbs. Get into the dimension of greed, hatred, and delusion in your own mind, and then you'll begin to see ways to transform the evil in the world. I know that's hardly practical, but that's all I know to do.
On that note, and thank you so much for a really helpful, practical talk, we're going to end at least the formal part of this discussion, so we'll have a chance for more informal individual discussion after, but we'll close with the four Bodhisattva vows, which we chant at the end of our events. And those who know it, please proceed.
Being harmless, I vow to free them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them.